You were in San Francisco covering the opening weeks of the 1945 UN conference when you became a war correspondent for the North American Newspaper Alliance and the Western Newspaper Union. This took you on a world tour of 19 countries, including wartime China, then to Nuremberg, where you covered the trials of the German war criminals. Did you have any experiences during this period which might have increased your interest in covering the United Nations?
Western Newspaper Union, which was a boilerplate operation for small weekly newspapers across the country, asked me if I would like to go on a trip being planned by the Air Transport Command to take correspondence to Northeast India and across the hump of the Himalayas into China to see how the search and rescue operation was being conducted. Search and rescue operation was an effort to try to save the planes that were ferrying men and material into China by the back door, so to speak, because China had closed off the front door and the war was still going on there. I said no, because I wanted to go to San Francisco. And furthermore, the man I was assistant to, Mr. Balkage, H.R. Balkage, of the Blue Network, said he didn't think a woman should go into a war zone, and therefore he didn't approve of my accepting. So I went off to San Francisco and was very happy to do so, because it turned out to be an exciting experience. Anyhow, after about 10 days, I realized that the Charter of the United Nations was not going to be ratified or approved in a few days, especially with with representatives of 51 nations presenting their own points of view, and particularly V.M. Molotov, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union. So one day when I was sitting in the beauty parlor having a manicure, I suddenly thought, well, how silly not to go on this trip to the Far East. How exciting it would be. So I came out of the beauty parlor, called the Air Transport Command in Washington, said if that place is still available for that trip to the Far East, I am willing to go. And I was told by the officer at the other end of the line, oh, I'm sure it isn't available, because after all, it was 10 days ago and you turned it down. So I went back to my business in San Francisco, received a call almost immediately from this same officer in Washington saying, well, we do have a space if you'd like to take it. And I said, fine, I'll take it. So then I finally told Mr. Balkage, who was not very happy about it, but nevertheless he couldn't do anything about it. So I had to leave for Washington immediately to get uniforms and the necessary shots and so on to be able to take off. All this is by way of saying this gave me an opportunity to see what war really is and what it means to try to have some kind of an organization to prevent such a catastrophe. We went by way of the Azores and North Africa, through the Middle East, across what was then India, which is now Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, into Northeast India, to Chabwa, over the hump into China, and then eventually back by way of, again, of North Africa. And this time we came up through Italy and into Germany and back. I saw such terrible devastation in Italy and Germany and India and so many countries that I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe that people, human beings, could act this way. And as a consequence, if I ever was sold on an effort to try to prevent war, I was sold then. I think I'd been sold before I went over, but I was more sold than ever. And so this only reinforced my interest in trying to follow through on anything I might ever be able to do to try to prevent another war. And this eventually led to my coverage of the United Nations.
Thank you.
On returning to Washington, I was there in time for D-Day, which was, of course, a great emotional experience. But if I was ever moved by one thing, any one thing, it was that I had to go back and see more of this terrible thing that had happened to other people, people in Europe particularly. The Nuremberg trials of the Nazi war criminals were coming up the first of the year, and so I decided that my next move was to get out of Washington. How could you cover this vast story in Washington anymore? I wanted to go to Nuremberg and see these criminals in the dock. And so as a consequence, I went to Nuremberg. And I was there until June of 1946.
In late September 1946, now as a political correspondent for the American Broadcasting Company, you traveled to England on the SS Queen Mary's last voyage as a troop ship, with General and Mrs. Eisenhower on board. You returned the following month on the maiden voyage of the Queen Elizabeth. Your fellow passengers were 150 delegates to the first UN General Assembly in New York, including Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov, UK delegation head Philip Noel Baker, and US Senator Tom Connolly. What stands out in your memory of those voyages?
Of course, first of all, the fact that the Queen Mary was going back to dry dock to be transformed again into a passenger liner, a liner for carrying passengers in peacetime after carrying so many warriors, so many men to war. And General Eisenhower being aboard the ship. Well, I did some broadcasting from London, too, but it wasn't that going to be important. On the way back, of course, on the maiden voyage of the first Queen Elizabeth, we had many distinguished passengers aboard, and I had the exciting experience of interviewing them. Many of them from the bridge of the ship the night we took off and during the voyage. Of course, the most outstanding passenger news-wise was V.M. Molotov again, whom I had, as I said, seen in San Francisco. Molotov was the focus of all the media attention. There were quite a few correspondents on this ship. And I remember that some of the more seasoned of the reporters, shall I say, who felt they belonged to the prestigious media, the magazines mostly, like Life and Time, and the television was not very much in the picture at that time, not at all, as a matter of fact, and radio was a little bit behind the scenes. But anyway, some of the prestigious correspondents of these well-known media decided that we should all cover Molotov, that nobody should get a scoop on. And as a consequence, they decided we, all of us correspondents, should meet twice a day and exchange all the information we had on Molotov. If he was seen walking down the deck, taking his constitutional or having a drink or doing anything or saying a few words, which he never did, of course, in public. we were to report those things. So this was a very exciting experience. But as far as content was concerned, Noel Baker, who was coming to the United Nations, was more exciting, more forthcoming type of personality. And the members of the American delegation were coming back from the Paris Peace Conference. There was a small peace conference in Paris at that time, and that's the reason why Senator Tom Connolly was aboard.
You barely had time to lose your sea legs before you were plunged into covering the first session of the UN General Assembly held at Lake Success in Flushing Meadow. As if that weren't enough, you were also assigned to cover the meetings of the Big Four Council of Foreign Ministers being held at the same time at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Can you tell us something about the circumstances of these assignments and how the Foreign Ministers' Conference related to the work of the UN?
Well, the opportunity to cover the foreign ministers came about most unexpectedly and for a very unique reason, not particularly unique in these days, but it was in those days, because I was a woman. You see, at that particular time, broadcasting, which was merely radio then, no television, felt that women should not be heard on the air because they didn't have authority in their voices, and therefore they couldn't discuss serious subjects like international affairs, which is what I wanted to discuss. So I'd been sent out on various and sundry nonsensical things, in my view, that fashion shows and forum on how to get a husband and so on. And one night I was sort of hanging around the newsroom hoping something would happen. And there was a male correspondent there who was on staff. I was at that time merely a freelance. And the editors looked up and said, you know, there are two stories to be covered tonight. One is a truck strike meeting, and the other is the Council of Foreign Ministers. He looked at me and he said, you're a woman. I don't think I should send you to the truck strike meeting because there might be violence. I think you better cover the Council of Foreign Ministers. Well, I was very pleased and excited because the only reason why that particular slot was open that night was that the big shots, the male shots, who were the network correspondents like Elmer Davis and Raymond Swing and Martin Agronsky and H.R. Bockage, who had been brought to New York to cover the foreign ministers at the Waldorf, had to go back to Washington. They couldn't wait around for Mr. Molotov to make up his mind about the treaties for the little Axis nations. And so as a consequence, the slot was left open and I was asked to fill it. So I did. And I covered the foreign ministers every night then at the Waldorf until their adjournment some weeks later. And I was very excited about it. Of course, the four foreign ministers were Secretary of State James Burns, D.N. Molotov of the Soviet Union, Foreign Minister Bevin of Great Britain, and Foreign Minister Bidault of France.
After covering that first UN General Assembly in New York, you went on to report and comment on virtually all the assemblies that followed, as well as the Security Council, the other councils, and the work of the United Nations and its agencies as a whole. Through the years, you have known and talked with the famous people from many countries who have played important roles in the growth and development of the World Organization. As a result, you enjoy an unusual vantage point from which to appraise what the United Nations has done so far and where it may be headed in the future. To go back to the very early days, there was apparently a striking difference between the general atmosphere and public attitude that existed in the United States toward the United Nations as compared with those which prevailed toward its predecessor when the League of Nations was founded. How would you describe this difference in the light of what you observed in Washington and San Francisco in 1945?
Well, of course, at the time of the founding of the League of Nations, there was that little group of so-called willful men in the United States Senate, mostly Republicans, Henry Cabot Lodge, William E. Borah, and the like, who decided that this was to be the end as far as the United States was concerned. The United States would have nothing to do with it. So they led the fight against the League of Nations and succeeded in defeating it. I have often wondered if, as a result of that, with the coming on of World War II, there wasn't some sense of guilt in Washington, not among these little, this little group of willful men, because they apparently were too old to care. Anyhow, there were those in Washington who decided that this time there had to be some kind of an organization to prevent even a third world war. And of course, this group was led by President Roosevelt. Roosevelt was very anxious to have this United Nations succeed. He had many conferences, particularly with Winston Churchill, about it. But unfortunately, he died before his dream could be realized. So Harry Truman took up the cudgels. And Harry Truman named to the delegation to San Francisco for the signing of the charter a Republican and a Democrat, a very important Republican, Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, and Tom Connelly of Texas was the Democrat. And they were to lead the delegation to the San Francisco conference. Before leaving, they addressed their colleagues on their coming mission in the United States Senate. And at the conclusion of the speeches, there was, as one observer described it, an uproar of approval in the unusually staid Senate chamber. Members on both sides of the aisle, which separates the parties, as you know, arose clapping and surging toward the two men to shake their hands and embrace them. Vandenberg warned his colleagues that he and Connelly could not hope to chart the millennium in San Francisco, nor could they be expected to bring back perfection. But the charter they did bring back was almost unanimously approved by the United States Senate on the 28th of July, 1945. The vote was 89-2. The vote in the Senate reflected the feeling in this country that here was at last an opportunity to try to prevent another world war. But unfortunately, too many people thought it would be so easy, that all the UN had to do was press some buttons and you'd have peace instead of war. As it turned out, this wasn't the case. As a matter of fact, there was one group that formed the so-called 3-cent club. 3 cents on a postcard to your senator asking him to vote to ratify the UN Charter, and there would be peace. Well, as we all know, it turned out that peace isn't that easily achieved, and there were too many factors involved. But it remains to be said that at San Francisco, there was great excitement and great hope that somehow or other, at last, the time had come when nations were going to be wise enough to lay down their arms and try to go to the conference table.
The United Nations, when it first came into being, was quite different from what it has become in more recent years. What, in your opinion, are some of the main differences?
Of course, when the United Nations was created, the fathers and mothers, so to speak, very few women involved, unfortunately. Anyway, they created a creature that reflected to a great extent the white Western cultures of the North. At that time, the 51 members reflected these particular cultures. So therefore, the UN was concerned with reflecting this point of view. Moreover, there were two major problems bothering the founders of the United Nations. That is, that that Germany and Japan would rise again in their military might, and therefore everything had to be done to try to prevent them from again being aggressive. So much of the charter itself sort of reflected an attitude toward preventing Germany and Japan from rising again. Now, as we all know, as time went on and many of the colonies achieved independence by one means or another, so that a lot of small nations from other areas of the world reflecting differing points of view, economies, and cultures were brought into being. And the first thing these new independent nations wanted to do was to become a member of the United Nations. So as a consequence, as time went on, these little nations were admitted one by one, many of them small, many of them poor, and most of them from the southern part of the world. They became known as the Third World Nations. And as a result, their points of view became more implanted into the UN. Their voices were raised in the interest of better economies, greater, an end to all colonialism and various issues that interested them. And as a consequence, you had, instead of the big division between the United States and the Soviet Union, you really had a three-way split between the Soviet Union and the so-called free nations represented by the United States and the small third world nations. And these two began to reflect new programs for the United Nations and new interests and new difficulties in trying to work out some of the peace, some of the issues that it had been hoped could be achieved by peaceful means.
Unlike the League of Nations, the United Nations was empowered by its charter to enforce peacekeeping decisions of the Security Council with the concurrence of the Council's five permanent members. What considerations led to the choice of countries to be the permanent members?
I think the first consideration was how many divisions does the other country have, to sort of paraphrase something Stalin said about the Pope. Because in order to enforce decisions, it was felt by the original members of the UN that there had to be power enough to counteract any new aggression by Germany or Japan. As a consequence, Churchill and Roosevelt decided that perhaps the big policeman for the Security Council, which is what they were originally thought of as, should include the Soviet Union, because whether the USSR was liked or not, the fact remained it had power and military power, and that's what was needed. So the Soviet Union and, of course, the United States and Britain were understandably three of the five members, whereas China and France were thought of as belonging to this group, and they became the five permanent members practically by a decision, I guess, of Churchill and Roosevelt.
The early years of the Security Council's work were marked by dissent among the permanent members. What stands out in your memory of this?
The thing that stands out particularly was the emergence of a word that is never even used in the UN Charter. That's the word veto. In the Security Council provisions of the Charter, it was said there had to be a concurring vote among the big five permanent members, the five policemen, in order for a substance issue to have any validity. And it was assumed then, of course, that if there was not a concurring vote, a vote in opposition would be, in effect, a veto. This was not used at the beginning. This device was not used at the beginning when the Soviet Union was the first nation to be hailed before the Council. It was called in because of an arrangement during World War II for Britain and the Soviet Union to station forces along the Iranian border in order to protect the oil wells from seizure by the Germans, made it possible after the war for the Soviet Union to begin extending its influence without the validity of this agreement that had been previously arranged by the big powers. So, as a consequence, Iran decided to bring before the Security Council a complaint that the Soviet Union was interfering in its internal affairs. At first, the USSR, represented then by Andrei Gromyko, who is everlasting apparently, did not try to refute very strongly the issue that was brought before the Council, and it certainly did not use the veto in those days, although there were occasions when Andrei Gromyko became annoyed and said that Council did not have the right to discuss the matter and would walk out. In those days, the Soviet Union was not sure about the power the Security Council might exert. So consequently, very cautiously along this road, without being too obstreperous. And when it found that after a while, the Council really didn't have any power, or if it did have any power, didn't exert it, then the Soviet Union became braver and began using the veto. And so as a consequence, this became the well-known instrument at the hands of the Soviet Union, and the veto came into the parlance of international diplomacy, even though it wasn't even mentioned in the charter. Not only did the Soviet Union use the veto in an issue, but Andrei Gromyko decided one day to veto whether or not a question was vetoable, and then having vetoed that, vetoed the question itself, and this became known as the double veto. As a consequence, this was an issue that aroused the anger, particularly of the representatives of the United States. I remember standing outside the Security Council chamber just after Gromyko had cast a double veto, and Warren Austin, who was then our permanent representative, came bursting out the door, his pink cheeks pinker than ever. And I saw him and said, "Have you any comment?" And he said, "I'm so mad, I don't know what to do." And then he went on to say, "But I understand why the Russians do something like this. They are always in a minority. We always have the majority. And consequently, in order to try to prove to the world that they too, the Soviet Union also, is a major sovereign power, it exerts the veto. And that's the reason why they do it."